Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Poverty, politics, and jobs, and how to make them in the news this week, plus a Medal of Honor winner and Jackie Kennedy. At North Carolina State on Wednesday, the president said that the Republicans who talk about job creation need to get behind his bill now.
If you're in favor of America's jobs creators, this is your bill. This will actually help America's job creators. So we need to pass this jobs bill right away.
After a week of quiet nodding, House Speaker John Boehner took a different tack.
This isn't that hard. What we need to do is liberate the economy from the shackles of Washington and let our economy grow. I think we need to trust in the good judgment of the American people.
And a new cache of tapes from the young Jackie Kennedy, smart, candid, here on Life with the Kennedys and her husband, JFK.
If you didn't get on the offensive, they'd have you on the defensive all night. And so these questions he'd ask me or my sister. So once I asked him how he defined himself, and he said an idealist without illusion.
An idealist without illusion. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes, Tony Blankley, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Who's got it right on job creation, on taxes, on Social Security? What's up with Europe, with Solyndra, with Michelle Bachmann? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy Cordes, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Also from Washington, Tony Blankley, syndicated columnist, former editorial page editor at The Washington Times, spokesman back in the day for Speaker Newt Gingrich. Tony Blankley, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
And hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Tony.
Let's go right to the president and speaker. First, the president out on the trail. Here he was speaking to that crowd you heard at the top at North Carolina State University in Raleigh on Wednesday, urging his supporters to contact their congressman, urge them to vote for his jobs bill.
We've got to start manufacturing and selling more goods around the world. Stand for three proud words: made in America, made in North Carolina, made in Raleigh. We need to build an economy that lasts. And Raleigh, that starts now.
I love you, Barack.
I love you back. That starts. But if you love me, you got to help me pass this bill.
The president getting a whole lot of love right there, but maybe not quite so much in the national polls. And then House Speaker John Boehner, Republican, Ohio, of course, outlining a Republican jobs plan yesterday at the Economic Club in Washington. In a Q&A session following the speech, the House Speaker said that he and the president don't overlap much in their views.
Sometimes the conversations that we have would be like two groups of people from two different planets who barely understand each other. And I don't mean it in a derogatory way, but there is a reason why you have two major political parties with big disagreements.
Two different planets. Oh, boy. Nancy Cordes, a week ago, there was a kind of, you know, some quiet nodding and musing and not big, fierce opposition from the GOP. This week, John Boehner coming out with a very different vision of what he'd like to see on jobs. Where does that leave the president's push? What about a Republican alternative? Where does this all stand, Nancy?
Well, what the speaker said yesterday was clearly that he thought that the president's plan wouldn't do very much. And in fact, he called it a poor substitute for pro-growth policies, by which he means policies that strip out regulations that he thinks hamper job growth. He didn't refuse to work with the president. He didn't go back on his pledge, but he did make it clear that there were going to be parts of the president's plan that might not make it past the House. I think he was, in a way, inoculating Republicans so that if this jobs bill doesn't do that much, they can say, well, we wanted to work with the president, but we never thought it was going to create many jobs.
Tony Blankley, he didn't say he wouldn't work with the president. On the other hand, the president's plan depends on new taxes, on upper-income Americans. That's right baked in there to make it all work. And John Boehner saying yesterday, essentially, no new taxes.
Yeah, I was actually at the luncheon as a guest of the club. I wasn't covering it, and about 15 feet from Boehner. I think his tone was reasonably amiable to the president. He was firm on taxes. That was, of course, I think the big message coming out of that luncheon speech, which is no position other than that which he has to take. The Republican Party's not going to, and everybody knew Republicans not going to vote for tax increases. I think the president's problem, and he's obviously, I think, helping himself with his base. The trouble is at 39 or 40 or 41 or 42% approval where he currently is, he has to have a strategy that does more than keep reasonably happy his base. And I'm not sure that failing to negotiate with the Republicans in advance of trying to come up with a bipartisan jobs bill, which might have done good for him with the independents, running the campaign, which is pretty much what we've got now, I don't know how that helps him from the base, the low, fairly low base he's at right now.
All right, so new taxes is the Republican posture, but he had not come out yet, others had not come out yet, saying for this super committee that sat down for the first time this week, the Congressional Super Committee, sort of pre-stating what should or should not be in the package of things they come up with. Here he was talking about that committee and its work at the same Economic Club meeting in Washington. John Boehner.
It's a very simple equation. Tax increases destroy jobs. And the Joint Committee is a jobs committee. Its mission is to reduce the deficit as threatening job creation in our country. And we should not make its task harder by asking it to do things that will make the environment for job creation in America even worse.
Nancy Cordes, this all is works together, at least as the president sees it. Now here's John Boehner saying, no, even in the super committee's work, we don't want new revenues from new taxes. What does that do to the possibility of working with anything in common with the president and to the agenda that's sitting in front of the super committee right now, Nancy?
Well, one of the things that both the president and John Boehner have said is that they think that the super committee should try to tackle comprehensive tax reform. In fact, that was, I think Tony would agree, a major thrust of Speaker Boehner's speech yesterday, calling on this super committee to wipe out loopholes, deductions, tax credits, special interest giveaways, and in exchange, dramatically lower rates for everyone. And this is not new. This is something that all three bipartisan deficit committees over the past year have proposed as well. Both Democrats and Republicans think that that is something that could dramatically spur growth. You could raise some revenues from it while credibly saying that you aren't raising anyone's taxes, you're lowering all their rates. Of course, this is something that in practice has been incredibly difficult for Congress to do for decades, because anytime any large industry, oil and gas industry or what have you, sees that their giveaways might be going away, they put on a full court press and the lobbyists win the day. The thinking now is that this super committee is so insulated that they actually could achieve some of these things that Congress hasn't been able to do before. And in fact, we saw a rather unusual sight yesterday where 32 senators, that's a third of the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, came forward and said, if you make some of these tough choices that Congress hasn't been able to do before, we will stand behind you, we will support you, and we will give you the cover you need to do that.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Did the speaker punch a hole in the insulation with his remarks on taxes, or just state the obvious about the GOP? And what about the president's jobs bill here? Not only Republicans expressing disagreement and dragging feet, Jack.
No, to the latter point, some Senate Democrats have jibbed about it. Senator Casey, for example, from Pennsylvania, said it's too long. We want a shorter bill. Senator Hagan from North Carolina said, yeah, the bill is too long. We want bills in little pieces. I guess the idea, they were afraid that an opponent would say you went for another big Obama bill, make it smaller. Not exactly an inspired criticism, and something that can't give the president any confidence that he has his party behind him. On Speaker Boehner, you know, his comment, tax increases destroy jobs, is empirically questionable. I mean, President Reagan raised taxes several times. We had a jobs boom. President Clinton raised taxes. We had a jobs boom. Doesn't seem that that's the case as an empirical proposition. And I do think that this tax reform does seem to be the I don't know if the deus ex machina is the word, but at any rate, a possibility of some kind of movement that would at once create more revenue and therefore deal with the deficit question, and correspondingly limit the kinds of cuts that will have to be made in safety net programs without some tax increases. I mean, that's so important here, especially since we've just got this Census Bureau report on poverty in America. The super committee simply can't do things that are going to drive more people into poverty.
Highest number of Americans in poverty ever in that report. Nancy Cordes, do you see things moving towards some action here or toward a freeze and paralysis back in the same deadlock that we saw over the summer and earlier last winter? Are we headed back there on the jobs plan and the super committee or not? Can
well,
you tell?
I think as far as the super committee is concerned, it's a little too soon to say because everyone on that committee that I speak to seems game to go for a big deal, you know, more than $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction, which is their task. They really feel like they can do something big here. But the question is, do they have the time to do it? I mean, they only have 2 months here to achieve their goal. And as Congressman Jeb Hensarling put it to me the other day, he's one of the two co-chairs of the committee. He said, look, I can come up with $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction in my sleep. It's doing it in a bipartisan manner that's tough. So everyone wants to work together. I get the sense that everyone got a real earful from their constituents when they went home in August, people saying, what is wrong with you guys? Why can't you agree on anything? And so there's a new spirit of bipartisanship. The question is, how long will it last?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news, record poverty, Obama and Boehner clashing on jobs, Democrats lose a key race, Jackie Kennedy speaks out of the past, and a big Medal of Honor winner with quite a story. Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Tony Blankley, syndicated columnist, is here, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Phoenix City, Alabama, and Lisa. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
My question is, how is President Obama's current jobs plan any different than Shovel Ready? It seems like it's the same thing with a new name.
Another round
of stimulus? Any different?
Yeah, is this?
It seems like it's another round of stimulus for roads, construction, bridges. These were the same things the stimulus was supposed to fix the last time and didn't.
Let us pick it up. Nancy, straightforward question. How's like and unlike what happened last time?
It is like what happened last time. And I think that, you know, Democrats would argue that actually it did have a stimulative effect. Republicans either argue it didn't or not as much as was promised. And the challenge for Democrats as they try to sell this plan is that there is still stimulus money from the first go-round that hasn't gone out because some of these so-called shovel-ready projects weren't shovel-ready at all. This time around, you do have Republicans saying that they are open to some of this infrastructure spending, partly because they recognize that our infrastructure is crumbling, schools are crumbling, and that if we want to compete with other countries, you know, we have to have infrastructure that operates in the right way. At least that's what the Republican leadership is saying. But a lot of Republican rank and file have the same concerns that you do, Lisa. They're saying, you know, we don't feel like we got a bang for our buck last time, and we don't want to go down this road again.
On the other hand, there's the economy visibly wobbling. Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that the stimulus did help here in Iowa. We have lots of construction going on our city roads, which need it desperately. I've seen many people at work. It is inhibiting traffic a little bit, but that is the price you pay to get your roads up to standards. At the same time, our governor, Governor Branstad, he forewent the money for the high rail system.
High-speed rail, okay.
Yeah, the speed rail system. And, you know, I think that's really unfortunate. Again, we're always going to need money. It's going to have to come from somewhere to stimulate the economy with federal dollars that come down to the states and to the cities is important. And I don't hear any Republicans talking about that. How do they expect our infrastructure to stay even? I mean, we're so behind other other countries. It's crazy. And I just, I think Boehner really did a disservice to his constituents, to the Republican Party, and to all Americans by coming out and saying absolutely no taxes being raised. Because as much as the rhetoric has been going about, you know, we've got this big widening gap between the rich and the poor, and the middle class is dissolving away into working class and lower working class. Nobody's, you know, that's sort of the rhetoric of the Democrats and the Republicans are like, no new taxes ever, ever, ever.
Laura, let us pick it up right there. Tony Blankley, what do you say to that perspective, that line of thinking about everything we're seeing unfold here, Tony?
Well, it's a curious fact that as big as spoiling as our government is, we can't apparently spend as much money as we can appropriate fast enough, which is why there's still some money from the first stimulus not yet spent. So as far as trying to have a short-term impact on the economy in some substantial magnitude, it's probably too late to do that for the president and for the country between now and November. I don't think they can shovel enough money out the door because of all the legal requirements before you break ground on project. We're all familiar with how hard it is to actually spend the money. Let me go back quickly.
Of course, the president says it's ready to go. It's ready to go this time. We can do it right away. Says it'll and of course, he has an interest in having it back before the 2012 election.
Yeah. Let me just quickly go back to the special committee because I have a super committee. I have a little different view. Mm-hmm. I think all of the appointees, House and Senate, Republican and Democrats, are all creatures of their leadership. So the leadership's going to decide what they want to do. And I think they can get something done. They don't – if you read the bill, they don't have to get the whole 1.2 or 1.5. What will be sequestered is whatever they don't get done. So if they get $500 billion of it done, then there would just be another
– across the board. Cuts for
but not for the whole 1.2. It'd only be for the 7, whatever the number would be.
Right,
so that they can get low hanging fruit, and I think they will. I don't know what the number will be. So I think they're going to be able to point to some accomplishment, but not the big one there. And I don't think that there's a policy available to significantly stimulate the economy by intervening with spending programs over the next 12 months.
Of course, President Obama thinks the opposite. He wants to be reelected. You had an interesting essay this week, Tony, on the incumbent in the White House and how that's been an advantage for so long, such a consistent advantage, and how this sort of changing reality of this low-growth, slow-growth, no-growth Western world may make incumbency a real burden, not only Europe,
too. Yeah, not just here, but throughout Western Europe, throughout the democratic world. We saw that in Denmark this week, yesterday, where the right-of-center coalition, which had got to power basically on cultural issues and somewhat to hostility of the EU, just lost in a close election to the left-of-center coalition because they hadn't delivered jobs. And I think that – so it's not just whether you're a right-of-center or a left-of-center party. Whoever is in charge right now, given the huge shifts that are going on in the global economy to the detriment right now of the West, is going to have a burden to get themselves reelected. I think Obama's in that situation. I think Sarkozy's in that situation in France, in Spain, in Portugal. We've seen it. We've now seen it in Denmark. We may see it in Finland. So it's a world democratic-wide problem that incumbency used to be the presider of prosperity, and now it's a presider over of anxiety.
And you're writing that often pushed incumbents toward a kind of play it safe policy, maybe some of Barack Obama's centrist talk.
Yes,
but if you only get one term, it's like just get in there and push
you're willing
policy.
To take more. Yeah, because kicking the can down the road makes sense if you don't want to upset things because you're likely to get reelected. If, on the other hand, you expect that if you don't shake things up, you're surely going to get booted out, you might try more radical policies. Either, as I say, this is not an ideological one. I could imagine a Republican regime coming in with harder, tougher free market policies or a Democratic regime coming in with harder left-of-center policies just because kicking the can may not work anymore.
Calvin in Sumter, South Carolina. Calvin, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you doing, Tom?
Pretty well. What do you think?
Here's the thing about the they love to bring this thing up about shovel-ready products and it didn't work. Then we turn around and go to these elections and we kick out the wrong people. The thing is this here. Is it the president's fault that these states wasn't ready to take this money when they gave an opportunity to get this money. These seven ready for, I mean, every state has an infrastructure that is crumbling, that I believe. And they should be prepared to have all these stipulations or whatever it is it takes to get this money. They should, it's their job to get the money. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do, Calvin. Of course, it's the president's job to put forward a policy that will flow through the system and work one way or another. But, Jack, you hear the frustration right there, and you hear it all over the place these days. Americans just staring at the reality of these poverty numbers, the reality of this nearly frozen growth at this point, and saying, come on, someone's got to lead and get something done here, Jack.
They are. Economists estimate, Mark Zandi, for example, who was an advisor to the McCain campaign, that the Obama plan, if adopted fully, would create a million nine jobs next year. Now, why is that? Well, because part of it is directed toward, I think, about $35 billion towards school maintenance and
improvements.
Improvements. Mm-hmm. And that's labor intensive. That puts people, to work fixing windows and that sort of thing. And it isn't the big kind of, quote, shovel ready, get all the engineering right sort of project. So the nature of it is different. Secondly, the public seems to be well aboard with the elements of this. It has plurality support, and elements of it have overwhelming support. For example, 74% in a CNN poll like the idea of giving states money to put teachers to work and firemen and so on. Overwhelming approval from the public for the pay for raising taxes on the affluent. Public is all for that. So objectively, the ingredients are there. It's the political issue. I think the quotation of the week, admittedly, it was an anonymous quotation to Politico, but it was from a Republican who said, why do we want to help him, Obama, out now when we've got him on the ropes? Well, of course, the country is on the ropes, too. And that seems to be what's missing here.
Let's look at the politics coming up on the GOP side of the ledger here. Tea Party debate this week. Everybody with eyes and ears on that. And right off the bat, Mitt Romney came out slugging on the Social Security issue. CNN Tea Party Republican debate on Monday. The former Massachusetts governor questioned Rick Perry, Texas governor, about his past statements, very recent, on Social Security.
But the question is, do you still believe that Social Security should be ended as a federal program as you did 6 months ago when your book came out and returned to the states? Or do you want to retreat from that?
I think we ought to have a conversation.
We're having that right now, Governor. Running for president.
I'll finish this conversation.
Maybe he will. Maybe he won't. Maybe somebody else will. Nancy Cordes, what do you see unfolding there with Mitt Romney suddenly standing up as the kind of big defender of Social Security after Perry's comments about Ponzi scheme and all the rest?
Well, I think that Mitt Romney sees an opening here to try to bring Rick Perry down a peg. He doesn't want Rick Perry being cemented into front-runner status. He'd like to try to change that as soon as possible. And sure enough, we saw some polls this week that showed that his lead was softening a bit. In a way, it's kind of ironic that all of these debates have centered so heavily on Social Security and how you would fix it, because, in fact, I think most in Congress would agree that the real problem in the short term is Medicare and to some degree Medicaid. Those are the programs that are really going to explode in cost and drive up the debt. And actually, Social Security is in pretty safe territory for many years to come.
Healthcare and one little angle of it became a big deal in that speech as well. Of course, Rick Perry had tried to mandate an HPV vaccine for middle school girls, young girls in Texas, to be given the Gardasil vaccine against that virus. Right, he was criticized by Michelle Bachmann. She came out after the debate talking with Fox News, Greta Van Susteren, and made these comments, which got her in some hot water.
Problem is, it comes with some very significant consequences. There's a woman who came up crying to me tonight after the debate. She said her daughter was given that vaccine. She told me her daughter suffered mental retardation as a result of that vaccine. There are very dangerous consequences.
The whole world seemed to jump on her right after that debate, saying, come on, this isn't true at all. No medical evidence of this. Rick Perry himself saying that's just flat out wrong. Rush Limbaugh coming in and saying she may have jumped the shark with these comments.
I'll tell you, Michelle Bachmann, She might have blown it today. Well, not blown it, but she might have jumped the shark today if she'd have just left it alone on this vaccination thing from last night. But she's now out saying that this Gardasil, the drug, now causes mental retardation. Somebody in the audience came up to her and told her that. So she's not, and that's jumping the shark on this. There's no evidence that the vaccine causes mental retardation. That's shame.
Tony Blankley, where do you see this GOP race standing at this week's end? The criticism there that Michelle Bachmann will say anything for an advantage. On the other hand, her voice was a loud clarion in earlier debates. You see Perry and Romney going at it. How do you see it shaping up, Tony?
Oh, I think Bachmann is, the air is going out of her campaign. The question is the air going out of Perry's campaign or not? And I think we're going to have about a month of sort of skirmishing. And we'll find out whether Perry, who obviously is a very shrewd politician, he's won three Texas governor's elections, and that's a very tough arena in which to win three biggest elections, whether he can translate that to the national audience. I want to see in notional polling in October how he does against Obama in Ohio, in Minnesota, in Iowa, in Wisconsin. If he's able to translate his regional skills nationally, then we're going to have a fight to the finish. I happen to think that Romney looks to be in a pretty solid position if Perry loses a little bit of air. Romney in his first campaign last four years ago was too aggressive against fellow Republicans. And this campaign, he's been too passive. Now he seems to have found about the right place. And I'd bet a little bit of money on Romney right now.
And then there was this moment, Jack, let me ask you all, but here was this was in the same Tea Party debate, CNN's Wolf Blitzer. Remarkable moment. Well, the audience got involved. He asked GOP Ron Paul how a hospital should deal with a hypothetical situation where a young person without insurance comes in needing 6 months of intensive care. Here we go. Listen for the audience response.
That's what freedom is all about, taking your own risk. This whole idea that you have to prepare and take care of everybody.
But, Congressman, are you saying that society should just let him die?
No. Yeah.
Let him die, yeah, says the audience. Jack, what's going on right there?
Oh, that was a chilling moment. One doesn't want to make too much of it. Activists at these sorts of meetings, you know,
get excited.
Yes, of course.
But
on
still,
on the other hand, this is a new note. Even in conservative politics today, Paul Krugman quotes Friedrich Hayek, the great conservative intellectual hero, really, in his famous book *The Road to Serfdom*, and he supported there a comprehensive system of social insurance to protect citizens against the common hazards of life. And he mentioned health care in particular. That was the sort of godfather of modern conservatism. Yes, you can't waste money, but the government has to protect people who are vulnerable. And that audience, I think, was really disgracing itself in that sort of... one understands how it happens, and one doesn't want to read too much in it. Nevertheless, it was chilling.
Tony Blankley, let him die, Wolf asks, and yeah, said the audience. What do you say,
not
Tony?
The audience. There was the big cheer was for free of the liberty, the first statement. The second
well,
one
excuse
had like
me,
about,
but the comments did come from the audience. The yeah, yeah, we can
no,
hear
yeah, yeah, no, but if you listen to the tape, which we just heard, the one about let him die, essentially, was a handful, and they were obviously Ron Paul people. Even Ron Paul didn't stick with that. He finished by saying, well, I worked as a doctor in a charitable hospital, and we're going to take care of it charitably. So even he, by the end of the paragraph, had got to a more civilized position. I think, you know, a number of hoots in a conservative audience, not even a fraction of the audience, is not much of an indicator.
But a memorable moment when the question is asked straight out, and there came that reply. Tony Blankley, please stand by. Nancy Cordes with CBS. Jack Beatty, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Serbian Novak Djokovic defeated Spaniard Rafael Nadal to win the U.S. Open men's title. Here he is hoisting the trophy.
Ladies and gentlemen, the 2011 U.S. Open men's singles champion, Novak Djokovic.
There he was. And bigger still, much bigger, retired Marine Sergeant Dakota Meyer awarded the Medal of Honor for extraordinary heroism under fire, saving 36 lives on one deadly day in Afghanistan. He's taken it humbly.
I'm the furthest thing from a hero. I'm a civilian. I pour concrete. I'm not a hero at all.
I'm a civilian. I pour concrete. He did a lot more than that. And in the capital of Afghanistan, the Taliban launched an audacious attack on the U.S. embassy and the neighborhood around it.
RPG, get down!
What is going on right there? We're looking at a week in the news, record poverty, Obama and Boehner on jobs, Democrats lose a key race, we'll talk about it, Jackie Kennedy speaks, and that Medal of Honor winner, syndicated columnist Tony Blankley is with us from Washington, D.C., Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News, and our own Jack Beatty. I want to turn to the race in New York, Queens, and a bit more, where Anthony Weiner, of course, who went out in sex scandal, his seat came up, and, well, we all saw what happened. Jack, what do you make of the result there? This was about as Democratic a district as you could possibly find. Republican Robert Turner won it.
He did. First time, I think, since 1924, a Republican has won that seat. And, you know, some eccentric factors, obviously. For one thing, it's the district with the highest percentage of Jewish voters in the country. And Ed Koch, the former mayor of New York, made President Obama's stand on Israel, specifically his call for the 1967 borders to be the basis for any future peace talks. He made that an issue. He said, let's send the president a message by voting for a Republican.
But the Democrat was Orthodox Jewish himself.
Yes, and the winner, Mr. Turner, is a Roman Catholic, but it was a send the message, and they sent the message, and you know, so even when you discount, when you say, well, this is a unique circumstance, look at the president's job approval in that district: 43%. Governor Cuomo, 75% in the same district. In New York State, the president was 86% among Democrats in April, 67% now. In California, a year ago, he was 61. Now he's 50 among Democrats. Even Vermont, where he got 67% of the vote in 08, he's down to 53 now. The president has serious problems with his own party all over the country. And, you know, I think really the best news for the president this week was the collapse of Michelle Bachmann, in a way.
If that's what it is.
If that's what it is, because that does mean Governor Perry's vote will be strengthened in these primaries. And I think the White House is just hoping against hope that Governor Perry is the GOP nominee. I mean, they point to the polls that show that, you know, 45% are less likely to vote for someone who denies global warming, 66% less likely to vote for someone who wants to abolish the EPA. They're hoping he's the candidate. And people like George Will point to 08 and they say that, you know, not that Senator McCain didn't win a single suburb of Boston, Philadelphia, or Chicago, not a single suburb around those cities. And the point was, this could happen with Governor Perry. He's just not right for that electorate. 7 in 10 Republican insiders in the National Journal poll this week said, don't nominate him. He will lose.
Well, I don't know. Those suburbs with big unemployment rates right now. But let's on that race in New York, let's listen for just a second. Former mayor of New York, Democrat Ed Koch. Here's an ad he made for the Republican contender, ultimately the winner, Bob Turner.
Electing Bob Turner on Tuesday will send a huge message to President Obama that we're not happy with how he's dealing with Israel. I'm a Democrat, a proud Democrat. And I'm supporting Bob Turner for Congress because he's the better candidate and because his win will shake up Washington to its core.
Nancy Cordes, how about it? We saw what happened in that race. Is it shaking Washington to its core?
Well, it definitely is shaking up Democrats as much as they try to say that this is a unique race with unique factors, which, of course, it is. But most races are. You know, they're worried. Democrats outnumbered Republicans in this district, registered Democrats, 3-1. And this is not something that took Democrats by surprise. They saw the poll numbers in the final weeks of this race. They poured an extra $500,000 into ads in the final week of the race, and it still wasn't even close. So I think that that is fueling some of the dissatisfaction you're seeing among Democratic lawmakers this week, all those anonymous quotes about the president, president's jobs plan and so forth, because people are just nervous in the Democratic Party right now.
Tony, what do you make of the race in New York? We had the other one in Nevada, Republican winner there as well, but New York had all eyes. What about it?
Yeah, well, Nevada, too, is important. Both of them at the same time beating the last election cycle numbers. So, you know, Charlie Cook runs a very shrewd assessment of the sort of the default position of each district. And in both of these, one a Republican district, one a Democratic district, the Democratic candidate did worse than the default position that district usually holds. So that's obviously picked up by the professionals in town, and they're seeing that it's not just one election by itself. I mean, special elections are special. And you know, we had one in New York 26 earlier in the year that signaled bad news for Republicans. Now everyone's forgotten about that. I think it's a combination of that plus the bigger factor is the Democrats in town don't see this White House developing a message that they want to carry to the election. If they thought that he was, you know, pumping away on all 12 cylinders with a great message and just hadn't quite delivered it to a couple of districts, I don't think there would be the panic, as James Carville calls it, that there is. It's a combination of the bad election results in these specials, plus a fading confidence in the White House's capacity to politically lead the Democrats for the next 14 months into the election.
A tough development for the president's message this week, as we saw solar energy company Solyndra in California, that had half $1 billion poured into it in the first round of stimulus, go bankrupt. It left the executive director of the Energy Department's loan program, Jonathan Silver, here defending that investment before a congressional hearing on Wednesday, saying that America was losing ground to China in the race for solar energy.
This isn't picking winners and losers. It's helping ensure that we have winners here at all. We invented this technology, and we should produce it here. The question is whether we are willing to take on this challenge or whether we will simply cede leadership in this vital sector to other nations and watch as tens of thousands of jobs are created overseas.
Yes, China is creating jobs in a hurry and investing much, much, much more than the United States in solar. But Republicans were all over this side-by-side. Here's the investment. Here's the bankruptcy. And there was more to it than that. Pennsylvania Republican Tim Murphy, member of the House Energy Committee, told CNN's Anderson Cooper on Wednesday that legitimate questions were raised long ago about that solar power company that President Obama had touted as a model of innovation.
It's all these other elements. It isn't whether or not the company could survive. And some of them don't. The issue was there was lots of signs before the first checks were written that it wasn't going to work, and lots of signs after the checks were being written to say we shouldn't go any farther.
Not to mention there was fundraising for the president by a key player in this company. Jack, what do you see in this one? This is going to be a tough one for the president to carry around in the next year.
Oh, it really is. The Chicago Tribune made a good point, and it would connect with Lisa, our first caller, when it points out that under pressure from the administration, which wanted to stage an event featuring Joe Biden announcing the guarantees at a groundbreaking ceremony, the White House was putting pressure, please, please, we want the groundbreaking ceremony. And the Chicago Tribune is a perfect example of a shovel-ready stimulus. You know, it's the kind of thing that gives government intervention in the economy a bad name. Industrial policy sounds like a good idea, and you can probably point to examples where it's worked, but in the main, this isn't something the government really, I think, should do or can do well.
But Jack, is that a 20th century observation? You've got China pouring billions, billions, billions into their solar energy and eating our lunch. You got American companies going out of business. I mean, we're not competing here with, I don't know, the United Kingdom. We're competing with China.
Well, we are, and they're willing to, you know, break their own rules, break rules of the free market, break rules of the trading, international trading organizations and so on to do that. But it's just, you know, for example, if what you want is more solar panel production, the way a government should go about it is through a carbon tax, give an incentive through the market rather than trying to, you know, create a market for which the demand doesn't seem to exist here or for which the demand is being met by other suppliers. We have a world market, and we can't pretend that we can just, you know, create a winner here when somebody over there is targeting our industry.
Nick in Melrose, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom. Thanks for answering my call.
Yeah.
Two quick points. My first is
with Republicans, getting big applause lines for things like denying, human involvement with global warming, and then making, kind of unscientific remarks about the dangers of HPV injections and so on. I'm just wondering, is there a history of, the kind of right wing of being sort of scientific deniers, or is that a more common revelation? And then also, if I may, I wonder why it is that nobody seems to point out the huge dichotomy between these holier-than-thou evangelical Christian Republicans and their absolute love affair with execution. And those are my two questions.
Well, Rick Perry's made no apologies about many, many executions in Texas. Science. Tony, what about it? John Huntsman raised that. Not this debate, but the last one, saying we can't win if we're seen as standing on the wrong side of science. Former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge has endorsed him now. Does that have legs? What about science and the GOP contenders, Tony?
Look, there's been a religious skepticism regarding science going back through both Protestantism in America for 100 years.
But this country was not built on skepticism about science. This country made its name on science.
And the Catholic Church. And to the extent the Republican Party is identified, I don't think we are. If it is, I think that's a problem. But it's not fundamentally, it's a quirky element of a faction within the Republican Party. And as long as the presidential nominee is not embracing that, then I don't see much of a problem.
But Rick Perry is. Evolution is just a theory, which is a pretty weird spin on what a theory is.
I mean, if you look at the public attitudes on creationism, I think there's a majority of the public that thinks that either creationism is valid or that God oversees evolution. So I don't think that whatever I happen to believe in the theory of evolution, but I don't think that's a political loser and has never been. I mean, Reagan, raised the same questions. That issue is not a loser. I think the anti-vaccine business, and you have a progressive attitude. Anti-vaccine attitude, which we saw a few years ago regarding autism, which has proved to be non-scientifically based. Mm. I think that's unfortunate at the minimum, because a lot of parents are not going to get their kids vaccines who need it and because they have a misunderstanding of these campaigns against vaccines. There's a lot of paranoia about anti-vaccinism on both the left and the right in America.
Nancy, I've got to look across the pond for just a minute here. Big trouble in Europe this week. Not clear if it's solved yet. This was the European Commission President Jose Manuel Barroso talking about the threat that is posed by the European debt crisis right on top of us here.
We are confronted with the most serious challenge of a generation. This is a fight for the jobs and prosperities of families in all our member states. This is a fight for the economic and political future of Europe. This is a fight for what Europe represents in the world. This is a fight for European integration itself.
Fight for European integration itself. Nancy, is Congress looking over its shoulder at Europe? I mean, it seems still the central banks are lining up to try and help. But if it goes down, warnings of global depression here, is it making an impact, an impression in Washington?
Absolutely. And I think where you're seeing the most impact, once again, is this super committee, because they are trying to figure out how much they should cut from the debt and how quickly. And the CBO director, the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan, basically went before the super committee this week and told them, look, the best thing that you can do for the economy is come up with a plan that cuts the deficit in the long term, but not right away. If you cut too much right away, you are going to slow growth. And if you look around the world at other countries in Europe who have imposed these very severe austerity measures, Greece, the UK, Ireland, their economies are not doing very well right now. And that's running into some resistance from particularly conservatives who feel that, no, we can't cut down the road. We have to cut right away. But the sense from the Congressional Budget Director and most economists seems to be that the best thing you can do is send a message to the American economy that, yes, we are going to get our debt under control, but we're not going to slash so severely that we're going to halt growth in the short term.
I can't leave this week without hearing just a little more of that voice from the past this week. Jackie Kennedy, 8.5 hours, new tape, interviews with Arthur Schlesinger from 1964, just months after the assassination of her husband, JFK, talking very candidly in her very distinctive way about her life in that presidency here, talking about the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. First Lady begged her husband, she said, not to send her and the children away from the White House, even though nuclear war was possible.
But I said, please don't send me away to Camp David. You know, me and the children, please don't send me anywhere. Even if there's not room in the bomb shelter in the White House, which I'd seen, I said, please, then I just want to be on the lawn when it happens. No, but I just want to be with you, and I want to die with you, and the children do too, and live without you.
If there's not room in the bomb shelter, Jack, Jackie Kennedy saying, I just want to be on the lawn with happens. I want to be with you. What a voice from the past.
Oh, my. How I miss her. I mean, I must say that as a young man, she was, well, one of the reasons I was such a big Kennedy fan. She was really, First Ladies are seen against their predecessors, and Mamie Eisenhower was a wonderful woman and so on, but she was not Jacqueline Kennedy, who was stylish and the patroness of the arts, and as we see there, a person of great compassion and insight, much missed.
An elegant, incisive voice from the past, whatever your politics, just absolutely charming and full of insight to hear again, Jackie Kennedy. I want to thank all of you for being with us this week. Really great to have you. Tony Blankley, syndicated columnist, joining us from Washington, D.C. Tony, thanks for joining us today.
Delighted to be here.
Nancy Cordes, the great congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, thank you as always. Wonderful to have you.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
And Jack, have a great autumn weekend there in New Hampshire.
Thank you, sir.
And out to Vermont. We hear it's going to be beautiful up there. They've had their flooding. Don't be afraid to go. Enjoy Vermont. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.